And for those of you who don't know what it's unfamiliar with the accretion disk around a black hole, it's just, it's, the black hole, it's sucking in all this matter around it. It could be a star off somewhere nearby, and it's within its gravitational grasp, and it's just drawing material off it, or it could be a dust or gas cloud nearby, and it's all this material. And as it's getting sucked in, the black hole is rotating. Most black holes are rotating, so this black hole is rotating, and it's drawing all this in. It's drawing all around its surface. You can think like it's sort of an horizon. And as it does, it's pulling it in, and the friction and speed as it's coming in causes the heat. As it's getting closer to the black hole, it's getting compressed more and more, and that's contributing to the radiation giving off. So it gives this glow, this bright glow, and that's the accretion disk. And that's what they photographed, is an accretion disk. And Bob, what you were mentioning about gravitational lensing, just dropping. Yeah, exactly. If you've got a galaxy, let's say behind a black hole somewhere, and the light is coming up from around behind it, or it could even be off to one side of it. As the light's coming around the black hole, it's getting trapped by its gravitational well, this incredibly dense, curved region of space. And light is being curved around it, and it can be amplified, magnified, and so you get this lensing effect. And so, yes, that's the other way they know they're there. They're also using that same line of thinking to look for dark matter. Just dropping. And another way for black holes, too, there's other ways to determine whether black holes are there. Back in the, I'm not quite sure what year it was, maybe in the 70s now, at the David Dunlap Observatory, just north of my location here in Richmond Hill, it was at one time a world-class observatory, put out a lot of very important research papers. One of the astronomers there, Tom Bolton, and he discovered the very first indirect evidence for a black hole. And this was in the constellation Cygnus, and the black hole is Cygnus X1. And how he found it, and it was because there was a star, there was this massive star, but the star had this wobble. But there was nothing near it that could possibly be disturbing this star. So that meant there had to be some huge mass that's putting out a huge amount of gravitational effect to be interfering with this star. And so further studies show, yes, there's a black hole there. Indirect evidence of a black hole. This is VH3K. Any additional comments, check-ins, come on in. And black holes as particle colliders.
Whiskey Juliet Lima Sierra with a comment.
And come on in.
Hey, good evening out there to everyone on the Science and TechNet. I think this may be my first time joining you folks. If I've joined you before, it's in the distant past and I don't recall. But so hello and thanks for having me. I'm a scientist. I'll just go out on a limb and say that and put it out there. I honestly, white holes sound like a stretch to me. I'm still not entirely convinced we understand black holes completely at all. I know we've got reasons because of Einstein to believe they exist, and I know we've made observations that we're convinced of, but personally I haven't looked at it closely enough to believe it 100%. And white holes just sound preposterous, but I haven't studied that very much. But if I'm honest, I think a lot of modern physics sounds like a guess, the Big Bang, not the least of a guess. It's almost like the absence of a theory. It's like a, hey, we popped into existence kind of thing. It's less of an explanation, more of a description of what you can observe than an explanation of where it all came from, in my opinion. W2JLS passing it back to net control.
And this is the KX. And white holes, first white holes, theoretical. I mean, mathematically, I can produce the equations that show that a white hole exists. It doesn't mean they do. Relativity covers the aspect of white holes. It says, there's no reason our universe can't accommodate them. but whether they're actually there or not. Black hole, a lot of what was discussed about black holes, other than what can be observed sort of indirectly regarding black holes, is still all theoretical. Nobody really knows exactly what's going on inside a black hole. There wouldn't be all these theories. Mathematical models tend to point to certain directions based on the characteristics of the physics of what you would expect from a black hole if you're looking at it in terms of a singularity. You take that a dense enough region of space, and yes, you collapse it down into a, let's say if you have a star that's at the end of its life, supernova, it's kind of a supernova, either goes into a white dwarf, can condense down even further to a neutron star, then it gets past electron degeneracy, and then you end up with a black hole that can collapse down even further. Extrapolate even further, it takes you down even further to other singularities related to the Big Bang, just dropping. But the Big Bang is the best explanation they have right now. It sort of ticks all the squares, but it's not the only one. There's a lot of things that don't explain what actually caused the Big Bang. Of course, they did mention about the cosmic inflation resulting in the hot Big Bang, but nobody really knows what happened with this cosmic inflation, what caused the cosmic inflation. Quantum fluctuations at the very beginning of the universe. The universe isn't a complete vacuum. There is vacuum energy in the universe. You can't have a complete vacuum. So this vacuum is always undulating, particles popping in and out of existence. So something gave this vacuum a little bit more energy, the Big Bang come out of it. What caused the vacuum field to start with? Lots of questions. Lots of questions and lots of theories. And this is VATKEX. And we'll push on to the next one here about black hole. I find this one interesting. I find this one interesting, and it's very plausible. And W3JLS, I think you may find this one interesting as well. You did say you had an interest in black holes. You might find this interesting. It's about using them as a particle accelerator. And scientists, they've been hoping for years now, that the Large Hadron Collider would spew out dark matter particles, and this would be a result of high-energy photon collision. So far, there's no detections. No such detections have been seen. It doesn't mean that dark matter can't be produced that way. It just means it hasn't been seen right now. To continue this research, the scientists, they would need new higher energy super colliders to be built, and that would take decades. And with the fundings that are being slashed now for science, it might even take longer than that to get a suitable super collider up and running. And these findings were published June 3rd in the journal Physical Review Letters, and it suggests that scientists might find dark matter particles in the really super violent collisions inside the extremely fast rotating accretion disk surrounding a black hole. We were just talking about those a few minutes ago. It's dropping. Inside particle accelerators, particles are smashed into each other in high speed collisions. And most of these collisions are happening just about at the speed of light. And they're producing some of the most fundamental elements in the universe in a very, very brief moment of time. In fact, collisions like this helped find the Higgs boson in 2012. That's the particle that helps explain why all other particles have mass. And so far, the Large Hadron Collider, it's not been able to produce dark matter particles. It could be because it can't reach the necessary energy level. Dark matter, it makes up about 27% of the universe's missing mass, and it doesn't interact with normal matter. And this would make it so hard to find. No one knows where it came from or what it is exactly. All we know is that without it, the universe would not exist in its present state. Just dropping. Just a little bit of further history on that with dark matter. The problem with detecting it, because it doesn't react with normal matter, how do you set up an experiment in order to capture results from that dark matter if it doesn't react with anything around it, baryonic matter, normal matter? So the only way they can do it right now, until they can come up with some sort of technology or technological process where they could detect it. And a lot of it's just through indirect means. Just dropping. And and because it's this missing matter of the universe, and it's basically holding everything together. The amount of matter in our universe right now, if you were to count it all, there wouldn't be enough of it there. There wouldn't be enough of it there to hold things together the way you see now. Universes or galaxies wouldn't stay together. Solar systems wouldn't stay together. Planets likely wouldn't stay together, et cetera, et cetera. And that's because the dark matter, it's out there, and its gravitational influences on everything is keeping everything together. Without it, everything would be just basically flying apart. So after the calculations are done and you look at how much mass is actually there, what we can see as to what would actually be needed to keep everything running the way it is, then you know something's missing, and hence the term dark matter. There has to be something out there in the form of some matter that's producing enough gravitational effects to keep everything in a state where it's actually running properly to drop in. So getting back to black holes, they emit these enormously powerful jets of plasma from their accretion disk. And these jets may have enough power to allow particles to collide at levels produced by future generations of super colliders. In fact, these jets are likely even much more powerful than any a future super collider we could produce here on Earth. And what researchers have in store is this. To find particles whizzing from black hole collisions, they want to track them. It's dropping. They want to track them with observatories designed to study supernova. Either things like even the South Pole's Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory, even a kilometer cube neutrino telescope, something like that they would be able to use. So hopefully, by studying the jets coming from these from black holes, they might just be lucky enough to find a signature profile sitting that of dark matter or a dark matter particle. So they're now considering trying to formulate some way to use an accretion disk to help them possibly find dark matter. And this is EH3KEX. A couple more on space, and then we'll move into a couple of other things here tonight I thought you may be interested in as well. The next one about asteroids around Venus, and there's some concern now that they one day they may end up slamming, or at least some of these may end up slamming into Earth. Before I go into this one, any additional stations out there, any comments or check-ins, come on in. And the asteroids around Venus might hit Earth one day. And well, you can see from earlier on in the net when I started off, so there's two asteroids I used as an example there, and you saw how close they came to us. Although they're very small, they still came in very close. They're within the orbit of our moon. And swarms of city killer asteroids, and they're called co-orbital asteroids. They're hidden from view around Venus. And new computer simulations show that these may one day present a really dangerous threat to Earth. These type of asteroids, they orbit the Sun alongside a planet or some other massive body without actually orbiting on a permanent basis. They kind of just tag along for the time being. Right now, there are about 20 of these orbiting Venus and likely many more, but they're just undetected. And all of these at some point originated within the solar system's main asteroid belt. That's between Mars and Jupiter. And some of these have been found coming into Earth orbit, and more are being found continually. The Venus asteroids are all more than 460 feet, 140 meters wide, and they're big enough to destroy cities. So if one of these were to hit, let's say, Toronto, where I'm living, or New York, or London, the population would be just about instantaneously wiped out. And this is why they're called city killers. And if once you pass close enough to Earth, gravity could pull it away from its gravitational anchor, which in this case would have been Venus, and put it on a collision course with us. And Venus comes closer to us than any other planet. It comes within about 25 million miles, 40 million kilometers at its closest. And this makes a trailing swarm of asteroids a credible threat to the planet. And because of this orbital pattern, a chance of colliding with Earth happens every 12,000 years. So we're not there yet, but there's a possibility that that could happen. And this is the H3Cast. Ken here, Science and Tech Net. If you'd like to join us, come on in. If you have a comment, come on in with that as well. And the next one is about our energy imbalance. And the planet's energy balance is really out of whack. It's really out of balance now. And there are scientists are really sitting up and taking notice of this. This is the H3Cast. If you'd like to join us, come on in.
Yeah, the H3WXW for a comment.
And come on in.
Yeah, hi again, Ken. Sorry. Regarding the asteroids, I think they're worried in the near future, within the next 5 to 7 years, I think, of an asteroid named Apophis after the Egyptian god of chaos or destruction or whatever he is. They're concerned about that one, I think, because it's one of the PHA's potentially hazardous asteroids, and they're saying it's going to pass within 30 to 40,000 kilometers of Earth based on the monitoring it for quite some time, for years, and that's what they figure is going to happen. It's coming that close. Also, just on the black hole front again, real quick, I think they've recently imaged spaghettification of a star into a black hole directly, I do believe. I think there's video of it somewhere. I remember seeing it. Really cool looking. I'm not sure if you've seen that. Nothing further. Back to you, Ken.
And this is the H3KEX. And yes, that asteroid, what, 2029 or so, there's a pass they're expecting it somewhere around there. The spaghettification of a star, that was they got a picture of that. And I didn't follow the entire report, but I'll have to go back to it and take a look. But incredible. It's actually incredible to see something like that. You're looking at this long trail of light coming from this star that's being devoured, and there's nothing except this little point where it just seems this material is now disappearing. So, there's another example of indirect evidence, or closer to direct evidence, but still indirect evidence for a black hole.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, thanks for letting me in there, Ken. I'll listen along here. Back to you, Ned.
And this is the H3KX. And just quickly here about one more thing about black holes before we move on. I'm talking about singularities. Singularities are a point within a black hole where physics breaks down. Relativity does nothing to explain really a singularity or what's happening at the point of a singularity in a black hole. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, has a bit different perspective on it. Relativity often suggests that once you get in a black hole, get down close to the singularity, all information is lost at that point to the universe. That kind of calls into question about entropy, because now you're, instead of adding entropy to the universe, you're taking it away. However, singularities are kind of a hard thing to swallow, because they shouldn't be able to exist, because you're talking about infinities. And if you start looking at the quantum modeling, you can see that infinities don't exist, and that information is never lost, regardless where it's being taken. So getting back to your comment earlier, a lot of theories. People still have no really great handle on a lot of this right now, until they can actually start making some direct experimental moves. They're not going to know exactly what's going on. Our planet's energy imbalance. The planet's energy balance, it's actually the difference. What it is, it's the difference between energy of that the Earth takes in from the sun and the amount that it sends back out into space. And because of greenhouse gas energy capture, the planet retains excess heat, which we're now experiencing as global warming, as the planet's warming. And data, mainly from satellites, tells scientists that the energy imbalance has more than doubled over the last couple of decades. And right now, the increases has exceeded the predictions of climate models. And looking at the 2023, the imbalance is shown to be, I think, about twice of what the models have actually predicted. And this was in the journal AGU Advances. This was written up May 10th, which wasn't too long ago. And there's some large trends are being seen in the last few years, and it's not really clear right now why. It's just increased. They just keep increasing. At first glance, the data seems to reflect the changing pattern of things like El Nino, but as the imbalance continued to grow, research began to suspect something much larger was going on. The energy imbalance is likely due to the fact that the planet is declining in its ability to reflect solar radiation. We're not sending enough energy into space, and this could be the result of reduction in ice sheets and reflective particles for aerosols from things like shipping. But no one knows for sure. Something's missing from the model. The fact is, the planet's energy imbalance is growing, and it's growing rapidly, and it's alarming. The scientists are now looking at this and reporting that it's alarming. Temperatures will keep rising faster and faster. Temperatures are expected to stabilize once we stop using fossil fuels, and if the imbalance stays high in temperatures, we can could stabilize. We'll just keep rising. So should there be some big surge in 2025 here, and even going beyond, then climatologists, they're not certain where we're headed with this, other than it's not good news. And most of the data for this imbalance is acquired by satellites, and four of these operate as part of NASA's Ceres mission. And they're scheduled to be replaced in 2027 by the Libera mission. Libera is a single satellite, but continuous data from additional satellites is needed as well. Just can't get by on one. Ocean temperatures can provide some data on how the Earth's energy imbalance is doing, but that only shows trends decades after measurements have been taken. So with those satellites, scientists are basically flying blind when trying to get a pulse on the planet's energy imbalance. Other than they know it's not good. And this is the HVKX, Kansas here, and if there are any additional stations out there, if you'd like to join us, you have a comment, come on in, and then we'll move on to a few other things other than space. And this next one here, about cannabis. And a new research report has come out that is suggesting there's an association that cannabis may be bad for a person's heart, whether it's smoked or taken as edible. And this research, it shows that, or at least it's suggesting that, similar to smoking, cannabis, consuming edibles containing the compound THC, that's tetrahydrocannabinol, may worsen cardiovascular health over time. And the study found that chronic smokers of marijuana have poorly functioning blood vessels, much like smokers of tobacco. This was a study from the University of California, San Francisco. And THC edibles also appear to be associated with the same problem. And this was published May 28th in the journal JAMA Cardiology. And these findings may counter commonly held beliefs about the health impacts of weed.
Weed is the best drug you ever have, but...
And I'm not giving medical advice here, but I'm just I've just summarized a report that I read. I thought I'd just pass along to everyone here. And, you know, a lot of people, they consider marijuana to be totally safe for the cardiovascular system. And this is a report come from Dr. Robert Kohner. He's the director of cardiovascular research at Huntington Medical Center, Mental Research Institute in Pasadena, California. And he wasn't involved in this particular study. So although scientists have not reached a complete consensus about the health effects of cannabis, the UCSC study adds to the mounting evidence that the drug contributes to the risk of cardiovascular events like heart attacks and strokes. And this is especially true for people with coronary artery disease or other risk factors like high blood pressure or diabetes that may lead to arterial narrowing. Just dropping.
JQ2, comment on that?
And Scott, come on in.
Yeah, I had a buddy. I'd go up there and party with him, and he'd smoke weed if he had a heart attack.
and he'd always say that we would make his heart start racing. KB3JQQ. And Scott, I'll share a story with you as well regarding that. Shortly after it was legalized here in Canada, and people could consume it in places where it was allocated for its use, homes, things like that. I was out walking. I was heading south of my home here to a local grocery store. It's open until 12 midnight. I was out, I think it was about 10 or 10:30, I was heading out. I was going down one of the side streets, and all of a sudden the car pulled over, and the fellow jumped out, and he started pacing around, and he was hollering for me to help him. He was very agitated. I come over to him, and he had just consumed some edibles. And he was having a horrible anxiety attack, and his pulse was racing. I think his pulse was absolutely racing. He was in complete panic. And I had my cell phone. I phoned 911. They came by and picked him up and took him to the hospital. So he was definitely having an issue with it. And cannabis and heart health. So to better understand how cannabis affects cardiovascular health, the researchers recruited 55 adult participants. There were three groups of them. There were cannabis smokers, THC edible users, and cannabis non-users. And to isolate the effects of habitual cannabis smoking or edible use, the study focused on cannabis users who reported using the drug at least three times a week, exclusively through their preferred method, whatever that might have been. To gauge each of the participants' vascular function, the researchers blocked blood flow to the brachial artery that's located in the upper arm, and with an inflatable forearm cuff. That's what they do when you take your blood pressure. They used ultrasound imaging to measure the artery's diameter before and after releasing the pressure. And this measure is reflected as the percentage of diameter change from the baseline measurement. Among the participants who did not consume cannabis, the researchers measured the average vessel dilation of 10.4%. By comparison, cannabis smokers and edible users had an average dilation of 6.0 and 4.6%, respectively. And this decrease in dilation is similar to what research observed in earlier studies of chronic tobacco smokers. And the more cannabis people use, as defined by the number of smoking sessions or milligrams of THC consumed by way of edibles per week, the more dramatic their impairment in dilation was. So why cannabis might cause this change in function, researchers ran laboratory studies to see how the participants' blood samples affected endothelial cells. And these cells line blood vessels and release compounds like nitric acid, or nitric oxide rather, that cause vascular dilation. And this vessel widening can be triggered by a substance called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. But the researchers, they exposed endothelial cells in lab dishes to blood samples from cannabis smokers. They found that the blood hampered VEGF stimulated nitric oxide production in the cell. However, blood from edible consumers and cannabis non-users had no effect on the cell nitric oxide release. That suggests that cannabis smoked and ingested the THC affect the cardiovascular system by way of separate mechanisms. And that idea is in line with a prior study from the same research team which found that secondhand cannabis smoke that was stripped of THC still affected the blood vessels of rats that breathed it in. And this study revealed it was only an association between cannabis use and vascular function. It's not definitive proof of how the drug affects blood vessels. And cannabis appears to heart, actually there's some previous research on this. Let's just back up a little bit, just dropping. There was some previous research, a previous report that cannabis appeared to harden blood vessel walls, but does not affect vascular dilation. That seems a little bit contradictory. Whereas the current paper reports the opposite findings. So there's a lot more research to be done. So as I said, there's an association with it. There's not a direct link to it, just an association right now, until more research is done. And this is VHVKX, Ken here, Science and Tech Man. If you'd like to join us, you have a comment, come on in, and then we'll move on to another one. And actually, one more on space here, and then there was one that Candace sent me a report. I read through it. Thought you may find it interesting tonight. Before I get to that one more on space, and we'll get into a couple of other things here before the end. I think we've got about 25 more minutes here before we tie the ribbons for this week's Science Night.
November, Zulu, stand by.
And William, I got you there, VH3WBZ. There was another station coming in just about the same time you did. You just happened to get in over top of them a bit. That station, if you come in one more time, come in slowly with your call sign, please.
Thank you very much, Tori, for a little disturbing. Kilo, Yankee, New York, Arthur. Sorry for the disturbing. Just want to make you so. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And you're not disturbing us at all. That's here each week, 9 p.m. I translate from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And it's a net just out to exchange opinions and ideas about science, technology, and just have a discussion about it. This next one is about the 2026, the U.S. budget, and we're talking about NASA in this regard, and it's going to be slashing up to 24% of its budget and reduce the workforce by about one-third.
Victor Echo 7, November, Zulu, Kilo Echo 2, Fox, Yankee, Yankee, New York, from New York City. My name is Arthur. So you guys from the in Canada Aviation Summit Conference, right? So you're talking about different things there, right? That's very good. So I just also checking lots of different information. So the very glad to people try to improving and going more far. Some the fixing and checking some more and more problems in the between different things what happened, because everything is going higher and higher technology, different stuff going much better, much improving. Everything is it's next every time something coming new, and we need to be make sure everybody ready for that, for new changing and new technology, maybe new computers coming soon with the light technology, and so we need to be make sure everybody understanding correctly, or just different stuff with robotic stuff, because the humans like to do lots of things, but sometimes it's going wrong. That is like that is so good, because people make attention, and every time be alert with something. Right, so I understand. Okay, sir. Please one more time your name. You see my information just in case, because I put there my email address and information look like that. So I don't know if it's visible for everybody, because now the time to everything by the internet and different technology coming on the ham radio. I was long time the very active the guy on the ham communication, and start from SWL from the school, and go and get my call sign in Ukraine, Uniform Radio 5 Echo Hotel Whiskey that time, and I'm come to America, try to improve in my stuff and going to the same way like my father even was also the ham radio amateur, and I'm follow to him. That's so great to be involved with that thing. So I like it very much, of that communication stuff and everything. Okay, thanks a lot. Nice to meet you,
wow.
Sir. Just could you please your name? Okay, that Aerolink Communication and Aviation right there. Okay, thanks, Mike, to you. Victor Echo 7, November Zulu, Kilo Echo 6, 2, Foxtrot, Yankee, Yankee. Stand by.
And inform these folks, this is not a rag shoot yet.
Yeah, this is VA3KX. And yeah, thanks for coming in there. And my call sign is Victor Alpha 3, Kilo Echo X-ray. The name is Ken. And as I said, we're here each Saturday night at 9 p.m. And to your comment about technology, yeah, technology is increasing almost exponentially, really, these days. And things that were once thought of as science fiction are now science fact. And, you know, if you were to go back even in the 1960s, medical research is leaps and bounds now, too. You go back in the 1960s, and heart surgery was really basically in its infancy. And a lot of people went in for heart surgery then. It was almost a flip of a coin whether they would survive. It was sort of a last-ditch thing to save a person's life. But nowadays, people go in. It's a lot of heart surgery, just routine nowadays, bypass surgery, et cetera, et cetera. Heart transplants now, extending people's lives. All kinds of huge things that are going on, almost miraculous, really, in the leaps and bounds they've made. So technology, yeah, it could have some good effects and maybe not some good effects, depending on how it's being used. All right, this next one. It's about the budget. And then right after this, about a tsunami, and then one about Candace that she sent in. But this one here about the budget for NASA. And on May 2nd, U.S., the administration, it had a summary, released a summary of funding plans for the next fiscal year as pertaining to NASA, NASA funding. And NASA funding will be cut by about 25%, so from 24.8 billion to 18.8 billion. And most of this directly involves science programs. On May 30th, there's a more detailed 2026 version of this budget pertaining to NASA was released. Just dropping. And NASA will be given 18.8 billion in 2026, and is the largest single year cut since 1961 when adjusted for inflation. And the fiscal year, it runs from October 1st, 2025 to September 30th, 2026. Next year, NASA science funding will be reduced 37% to $3.9 billion. In effect, this will cause the cancellation of several high-profile missions. Now, it hasn't been approved yet. This budget hasn't approved yet, but if it is, one example would be the Mars sample return, which this is aimed at bringing Martian material back to Earth for analysis, and particularly looking for signs of life that can't be analyzed by the rovers on the Martian surface right now. This will be canceled. Just dropping. And the New Horizons mission to explore the outer solar system after passing by Pluto, that'll be hampered as well. Juno is a probe orbiting Jupiter since 2016, and both of these will be axed. There won't be any funding to continue research for those. And Mars Odyssey and MAVEN are two orbiters that have been studying Mars for a whole number of years, and they may end up getting canceled. The European Space Agency, it had a life-hunting rover, which NASA would have collaborated with, will be impacted. NASA won't have the funds to participate in this cooperative research, and the rover is planned for launch in 2028, so not too long, about 3 years. And total cuts to funding will result in 41 science projects to be canceled, and this report came from the Planetary Society. NASA's workforce will reduce reduction from 17,391 to 11,853, and this is a reduction of almost 32%. And STEM engagement will also be eliminated, just dropping. And STEM, science, technology, and mathematics outreach for students. And the Planetary Society put out the following statement, and this is a quote from them. The radical and rapid gutting of NASA's resources will lead to a reduced productivity, threaten institutional knowledge, and create economic uncertainty in American industrial base. And they went on to describe the funding cuts as an extinction-level event for the space agency's most productive, successful, and broadly supported activity, and that is science. So until these cuts are actually passed by Congress, it's still unclear how much of it will actually come to pass, but right now this is just a proposal. So I hope they can keep the funding going.
Please, Mr. Ken, your prefix on your call sign, Kilo X, Echo X, please, could you please one more time, I want to make sure the guy got right sign, Kilo Echo X, Kilo Echo 2, Foxtrot, Yankee, standby.
And this is V-A-3-K-X, and yeah, it's Victor Alpha 3, Kilo Echo X-ray, and name is Ken, so it's Victor Alpha 3, Kilo Echo X-ray.
Well, thank you, I'm Garrett. Victor Alpha 3, Kilo Echo X-ray, Kilo Echo 2, Fox, Yankee. Thanks a lot, Mr. Ken. Thanks. Interrupting you something with the conference. So just I can listen and she got something very, very nice information for everybody. Thanks a lot. Thanks again. And glad to meet with you. Good luck to you and your family. Thanks a lot, 73. Bye.
And 73 of you. And we'll talk to you. We'll talk to you later. And as I said, we're here each Saturday night. And the next one is about a mega tsunami. And this one, it actually rang the earth like a bell back in 2023. Before we go into this, any additional check-ins, comments, come on in. And scientists, they made some direct observations of a really weird seismic event. And that, as I mentioned, it shook the world for nine consecutive days. Imagine nine consecutive days in 2023. And it confirmed its cause. There were two mega tsunamis that sloshed around in the East Greenland Fjord. And the gigantic waves, one was measured, and it's incredible, one was measured 650 feet, 200 meters high, or about half the height of the Empire State Building. It entered the East Greenland, Dickinson Fjord, and rocked back and forth for 9 days in September 2023, sending seismic waves just vibrating through the planet's crust. And the signal was initially a mystery to scientists, but ground and satellite imagery traced the likely culprit to the landslides in the fjord. The landslides unleashed the waves, known as seiches, and it was followed by the climate change-induced melting of the glacier behind the fjord. However, no direct evidence of these searches seiches were found. A theory. It's been confirmed by a new satellite that tracks water on the surface of the ocean. And the findings were published Tuesday, June 3rd, in the journal Nature Communications. Just dropping. Typically, scientists study the movements of tsunamis, these waves using satellite altimetry, in which they send down radar pulses that are sent to the ocean surface from way up in orbit, to measure the wave's height based on the time it takes the pulse of the return. And because the satellites have gaps in coverage and their instruments can only measure what's beneath them, they're unable to measure the difference in water height in areas like those inside the fjord. So to confirm the existence of the seiches, the scientists turned to data captured by the new Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite, the joint project of NASA and France's Space Agency. It was launched December 2022. The satellite uses an instrument called the K-band radar interferometer to map about 90% of the water across the ocean surface. And it works by using two antennae mounted across a boom on each side of the satellite to triangulate and return signals of radar pulses with incredible accuracy. Measuring the water levels with a resolution up to about 8.2 feet, 2.5 meters, along a 35-mile or 50-kilometer arc. So data taken from the fjord during the mega tsunamis revealed cross-channel slopes moving in opposite directions between between it confirmed their presence. So seismic observations made thousands of miles along, away alongside weather and tidal readings further enabled the researchers to reconstruct the waves and conclusively link them to the mysterious seismic signals. So the study, it's actually an example of how the next generation of satellite data can resolve phenomena that remain a mystery in the past. And co-author of this study was Thomas Haddock, a professor of engineering and science at the University of Oxford. So interesting, huge tsunami. And because it was rocking back and forth, it just basically rung the planet like a bell for days. It is a VHVK at Canada here, Science and TechNet, and I'm transmitting from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We're here at 9 p.m. each Saturday evening, 0-9 hours GMT. Any stations out there, if you'd like to join us, or you have a comment, come on in. And then I've got time for one more, maybe another, we can see, but one more for sure. If you'd like to join us, come on in.
VK2, Bravo, India, Oscar. My name is Mike, just checking in.
And Mike, can I, could you come in one more time? I've got VK2.
VK2, Bravo, India, Oscar.
All right, I've got you in. And this is VHVKX. And this one here, it's about a bobcat that decapitated a python in Naples, Florida. And I think the gist of the report is showing some of the wildlife that are starting to fight back from the amount of these, the population of these snakes, these pythons that are there. In fact, bobcats are usually the prey of these giant snakes. And the remains are still being investigated. And the remains, they were found near the city of Naples back in 2022. And this was a wildlife biologist, the conservancy, the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. And since 2013, the radio trackers were used to keep tabs on a male Burmese python. And during the breeding season, these male scout, air quotations here in the report, snakes lead scientists to fertile female snakes and their eggs. So researchers move the and euthanize the reptiles in an attempt to cull the invasive population. So they're tracking one in order to cull the population. On the 9th of December, the team, they happen to be tracking the snake. They give the name Loci. It was a 13-foot, 4-meter-long, 52-pound, that's 23.5-kilogram scout snake. And they expected to find the snake holed up with a female python. Instead, they found his freshly slain body. The head and neck were chewed off. The head was completely severed and buried beneath some pine needles that were in close proximity. And the research team, they started looking for what may have killed the snake, and the way the snake's head had been chewed and its head buried, to them, by all appearances, it seemed that it was a large cat. They thought at first probably a bobcat or a Florida panther. And Burmese pythons, they've been, as I mentioned earlier, they've been known to eat bobcats. And this particular bobcat apparently had seized an opportunity to kill this snake, Loci, while he was incapacitated. There was a cold snap that hit southern Florida a few days before the scientists found the snake's remains. And since male snakes are usually out and about looking for females during breeding season, the chilly weather may have left the animal stunned and sluggish. Reptiles, they regulate their body temperature by the environmental temperature. So when the temperature starts to drop below the rate where they can function properly, they start to slow down. And it'll actually just stop functioning until the temperature starts coming up. So it seemingly kind of predation events are becoming more common in the Everglades. And researchers are still collecting evidence, and they're looking for trends in how predators like these bobcats, even bears, and even the Florida panthers might be killing pythons. And there's a bit of a pattern emerging that over time, the ecosystem, according to the researchers, seems to be rebalancing itself, and they're fighting back. So now prey is now becoming the predator, at least in this one case. And this is EHVXKEX. Ken here. This has been the Science and Tech Net, and as I mentioned earlier today, or this evening, I'm here each Saturday evening, my local time, 9 p.m., in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, 0100 hours GMT, and we're here each week, and you're always welcome to join us. Any stations out there tonight, if you'd like to join us, come on in. I've got time for one more here. I didn't think I would, but I thought I'd put one more in here. This is about dinosaurs. I always try to include as much as I can on the science net, something about dinosaurs. And I have another one here, the final report here tonight on dinosaurs. And before I do this one, any additional check-ins, comments, come on in. And this one here, it has to do with digital reconstruction about the stride of a dinosaur and what information that stride allowed paleontologists to deduce about the animal's life. So Dr. Anthony Ramilio, he analyzed and reconstructed the Phoenix trackway. And this is the longest documented set of footprints made by a predator walking on two legs in East Asia. And for the first time, this dinosaur's movements have been reconstructed step by step, revealing how it walked, changed pace, and responded to its environment. In a sequence, there was a sequence of 80 consecutive footprints, and it extends for 70 meters. And it's basically it's just a, you'd say like a fleeting moment frozen in